Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, at History Chappie on social media. And in this episode of the podcast, we are joined by Peter Miller, who is an award-winning journalist, author, and translator. Born in County Down, Ireland, Peter read French and Russian at Oxford and lives in Paris and then Brussels as a reporter for Reuters in early 1981. That's the year before I was born, at the age of 26. He was sent as a correspondent to East Berlin and then to Moscow, where he lived for 3 years, from the death of Brezhnev to the rise of Gorbachev. His career, including the Sunday Times, Sunday Telegraph and the European, took him to Warsaw, Prague, Budapest, Bucharest and Belgrade, as well as throughout Germany. Peter was named Foreign Correspondent of the Year in 1989 for his reporting on the dying stages of the Cold War, his account of which, 1989, the Berlin Wall, my part in its downfall, was named the best read by The Economist. Peter, that's a pretty impressive CV. Thank you so much for joining us today on Versus History. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here. Yeah, I'll sort of start off by telling you the early bits of a career. I was born in Ireland and very much a pro-unified Ireland and pro what I thought would never happen, and now it hasn't, a unified Europe. And it was, in fact, because of the problems in Ireland that I lived through all through the 70s, I was very glad to see what I thought was going to be a long and lasting, at least part-time union between the UK and Ireland. And I went to university and I decided that I would take French, which I'd been learning since I was 12, but not German, which I had learnt for about 4 years. But I switched to Russian just because I thought it would be the most unlikely thing to do. I got away fine with it, although, a language due at school never is that as good as it could be. And I saw I'd lost a bit, but German came back to me. And then I went to join Reuters, having a bit of a footless tent. They said, right, we're going to send you to East Berlin. And I said, that's the one language that I don't speak very well. And yet I couldn't turn down Berlin because Berlin still had a magic there. And I'd seen Cabaret when I was 18. And I just thought I had to go and see what the whole magic of the place was about. And of course, arrived there only to find that I had nothing of a Berlin dialect, which is very strong and very thick. I often thought that Berliners laughed their head off when they heard about, in hindsight, when they heard Hitler speaking, because it was a bit like, sort of Streatham, London, Ich hätte dette Vater gemacht in Berlinerisch. And whereas to Hitler was a bit more like Cornwall, and I don't know what you're doing. Do you want total war, my boy? It was a very strange mixture. And I, in fact, for the first couple of years I was in Berlin, it was very quiet because East Berlin, East Germany was a little outpost of the Warsaw Pact. And nothing ever happened, really, because the war was there to prevent it. And I really thought that it might go on like that forever.
Thank you very much indeed, Peter. Well, what an interesting time to be alive. Thank you very, very much indeed. Tell us a little bit about your new book then. So it's entitled The Germans in Europe.
Yeah, that's very much a part of my history of living in the Warsaw Pact. And as you quite correctly quoted, all of the various cities, I mean, increasingly as the things seem to get more complicated as we edge toward 1989. But even still, no one thought the Berlin Wall would come down at that stage. I was more concerned with going out to Poland and then seeing gradually how things happened until after 89. We suddenly saw German unity, which really had been written off only 4 weeks earlier by both the British, the West Germans and the French. And then suddenly the whole thing went completely upside down. And then I had to start writing more and more about what the new unified Germany was like. And in that case, I tried to travel around the united country as much as possible and seeing what the fact is. Of course, Germany isn't really a country and wasn't a country until 1871, when it came together under the Kaiser, who was only king of Prussia until then. And really, throughout history, most people had thought, well, if one of these days there is going to be a united German state, obviously the capital will be Vienna. And that was because, of course, the Habsburg Empire had begun in Vienna had stretched at one stage to most of Europe, including Spain and indeed South America as well. And by the 1830s, despite having had to step down from a Holy Roman Emperor for Napoleon, it really looked like they were going to come to a German, an old German-speaking empire, and go to Vienna. But the Prussians by then had other ideas, because Berlin had been a pokey little city in the 17th century, but by now Prussia was a big power, and they regretted and resented the idea that Vienna would take over from them. And that was sorted out in a huge battle in 1863, which was at Königgrätz, which not many people in the rest of Europe know much about, but it changed the imbalance in Europe, and Prussia won. And then Austria was deliberately cut out of any idea of a united Germany, and sort of went away and sulked on the side, whereas the Prussians took to war again and defeated France. And therefore, the King Wilhelm of Prussia was declared German Emperor of all places in Versailles Palace. And from then on, history changed enormously as he gathered all the other states, which had been statelets before, from Bavaria to Schleswig-Holstein to distant Prussia, to East Prussia, and to Königsberg, which was one of the first places that showed there was a sign of a German empire to come. In fact, that's the opening chapter in my book, and I make a point of saying it's not Germany in Europe, it's the Germans in Europe. And that includes, apart from the main cities that I just describe and visit and explain their role in German history, it includes Kaliningrad, which is what Königsberg has been known since 1945, when after the Soviet invasion, Stalin decided he would make it his own. And then we go to Strasbourg, which is, of course, one of the head venues for most of the EU institutions ever since. And then back to Vienna, which to point out that this was the place that could have been an international, an inter-German empire. So the idea is to tick all of that, as well as then go to places that most people think is typically German, just such as Hamburg, Cologne, and Frankfurt, which was actually where the empire really started to take hold. The idea of a nation state, which specifically Britain and France think has been around forever, was actually really founded in the mid-19th century with the Prussian victory over the Austrians, and at the same time with the unifying of Italy. Until the 1870s, both Italy and Germany were no more than geographical expressions. And there's a lot of people who also get it wrong, particularly in the West, particularly in Britain, in fact. You ask them, how old is your country? How old is the United Kingdom? You very often get a surprisingly uninformed response. I mean, one of the things that made me think of it most was in the year 2000, when going down Whitehall, I saw a big advert for a military tattoo to be held, and it said, defending the nation for 1,000 years. And I thought, not quite. Exactly 1,000 years from now, this country, and by then it was only England, were about to face the greatest defeat in its history when a load of Frenchmen from Normandy came over. And in the meantime, it wasn't until 1707 that the Scots were careered gambled it into the United Kingdom, and now I would very much like to get out. So, and Ireland, of course, has been in and out and in a very strange manner, insofar as when I say how old is the United Kingdom, I mean in its current borders, which means that the United Kingdom will be 100 years old in 2 years' time. It's not commonly realised too that when everyone, particularly the British, say that we won the First World War. Well, it didn't so much win as that the Germans lost. And it's often not realised that if you look at Europe as a whole, if you ask someone which country lost the most of its territory in the 4 years after the end of World War One, they automatically say Germany. But in fact, the answer is the United Kingdom, which, losing 26 of the counties of Ireland, lost in territory more than the Germans lost by losing Prussia and the Polish borders.
Okay, I suppose I have to ask. I'm sure there'll be many people listening to the podcast who know perhaps a great deal about Germany and the German people. So what do you think, in your view, what preconceptions or stereotypes or myths about the German people does your book either implicitly or explicitly challenge, and how?
Well, it does, because, I mean, it's very hard to get the Second World War out of the British heads, and Hitler comes up with everything. And it's quite funny, because, like, going back to that battle between Prussia and Austria in 1863, Hitler was an Austrian at the time, actually had to fight to get German citizenship, which he only got about 2 years before he stood for election in Berlin. And had he not been given German citizenship by a little tiny part of Germany, a little tiny council, it's a bit like Nigel Farage coming from France and only being allowed to stand in Britain because the UKIP had a seat in Parliament. So it wasn't like that. And when after the failure of the Second World War, or success of the Second World War, it was always a common thing in Berlin to be said that Hitler was Austria's revenge for Koniglitz. So that needs to be knocked out of the British head. And at the same time, there's a whole different idea that the Germans are militaristic, and they have no sense of humour. Actually, I have a collection of German funny cards, and they are very, very good if you speak half-decent German. And German has a great sense of humour. It's not quite the same as the British sense of humour, but it is very much there. But of course, if you don't know the country, haven't lived there, don't know the people, and really very few people know any German at all. They all think that the Germans speak English. Well, some do. The Germans have another answer thing, that we speak English when we sell things and we speak German when we have to buy.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, now, your book's a very, very, very interesting one. The titles of the chapters take the format of the Germans and, with various titles. Could you give us a sneak preview of one of these, if you would, or unpack it for us, and outline some of the factors that our listeners might learn from your book?
Yeah, I can. I mean, it's very specific. I tried to make it be an approach on the German world, and in that case, more than most about Germany itself, the country that still exists there, which you have to remember, in 1871 was by far the biggest empire, biggest country in Europe, and collapsed in 1918, and then strove for power again in 1939, collapsed in 1945, collapsed again in 1947 when it was partitioned, and then has only relatively recently, come to be a united country again. If you ask me how old is Germany, I'd say it's, if you mean the Federal Republic of Germany, it's just past its 30th birthday. So that's very different. But I also then had to say, well, what are the Germans like? What things did they do? And there was about three things. There's seven or eight in it. And there are three that I thought would stand out most. One is sex, one is football, and the other is cars. I'll take them in just those three, for example. The Germans, and particularly indeed an originally Czech man called Porsche, who not only devised very powerful cars today, but was the first man who designed what is now called the Volkswagen. And the more interesting is that some of the first important things in development of the automotive world happened in Germany, and were some of the very important people. It was the wife of Herr Benz who first took the long journey of 119 kilometers in one of his early cars. No one up until then had ever done anything more than 10 kilometers. And she suddenly, Bertha Benz, as she was wonderfully called, took her son with her on the, claiming to be just going to visit her mother for the weekend. She got into the car and drove 119 kilometers in about 5 hours, having to stop to get more leather brakes put on the car. And then it was the other person who's also and a familiar name in German attitudes to the motor industry, which is also a former Austrian diplomat who lived in Spain, and he was very keen in both Spain and in Nice in France, joining in the races that were just starting up, where people tried to reach 30 miles an hour, a huge speed. And he did very well with another car called designed by the Benz family. And he thought he would insist on naming it after his daughter. And it's not everybody knows, but it's a very, very common girl's name in Spain. And so he called her Mercedes. And so he had the car became the origin of the word Mercedes-Benz. It's really, these are little things, backstories, but the things that people don't know. And again, moving to football, again, there's a, Germany has a dominating role in European football. And yet, one of the most important areas for it is the capital of Bavaria, Munich. And we have Bayern Munich, but we also have the other very much second rate team there, which is shares the stadium with Bayern Munich, and it's 1903 Bayern. And they had a very complicated story because the 1903, the junior team, were pro-Nazi, where Bayern Munich were quite tolerant of the Jews. So the Bayern Munich didn't do very well during the post-war years. And suddenly it all changed. And so there's a lot to be said there. And Munich itself, well, is the home to BMW. And you can just see the BMW dominates the Munich skyline. And comes after it, of course, is beer. But I could get onto that in a minute. But there's so much to be said about beer. They just took in mostly American troops who were based in Frankfurt, and they made money that way. And after that ended, the Germans had sort of become, well, it's a job, isn't it? And so prostitution has been legal in Germany for ever 50, 60 years now. And the only time that there's ever been fuss about it was when a big business company in the late 1990s took a treat for their staff to Prague and let them loose in the big swimming pool in Prague, which they hired for the day, and filled it with, very German this, they filled it with high-ranking and lower-ranking prostitutes, and every employee got a ticket to show which rank they were entitled to. Very, very strange. And the main thing that it was a bit of an uproar about it in Germany, but it wasn't about their morality. It was about the fact that it was considered they hadn't been paying tax.
One of the sections that leapt out to me whilst I was reading your book, Peter, was the Yankee refusenik who became a Bavarian polymath. Yes, one of the most fascinating figures in Bavarian history was actually an American. This may surprise those in America, Germany, and perhaps further afield, who may have presumed German migration to America was all one way, that is, from Germany to America. Could you tell us more about this interesting story?
Yes, it's a very interesting story, and he's a very interesting man. And in fact, he was actually British, but not for very long. He was a traitor to the Americans, and he was... grew up in America, or rather, I should say, in the British colonies in the 1750s, 1760s. And when the colonies revolted against him, he thought, hang on, this isn't right. And he joined the British army. But then he saw that the British army weren't doing very well. So he got on a boat and went what he considered home to London. And he was actually a remarkable scientist and a remarkable man altogether. Won several awards for his work with chemistry and with lights, and became an ambassador for the British to the US. But then things started to go a little bit wrong there, so he decided he would move over to continental Europe, and he went to Munich, and he was a horticultural too, and he got a job working for the King of Bavaria, and he created a garden, a big garden of the English style, which to this day is called the Englischer Garten. And it is the scene now for one of the greatest beer gardens in Germany. And he's a really quite a... His name is Rumsdorf, by the way. Yeah, and there's a statue to him in the centre of Munich at the moment, not far from the Botanical Garden and the Englischer Garten. And I've spent many an afternoon drinking a litre of wonderful beer in the Englischer Garten. And he then, in the meantime, became a general in the Bavarian army and was connected to with the king's mistress, and eventually had to get round to throw. She was thrown out for having affairs with the students at the university, and he went off to go with her, and eventually left and joined the moved to Paris and became a fellow of the French university. A totally fascinating man, bound from Rumsdorf, and he was born in Massachusetts. And in the end, he actually got he became recognised by the Americans too, who made him a fellow of the American science department, and he went on to found a part of a university and became based on American hero, a British hero, and a Bavarian hero. Fascinating man.
You state in the conclusion, Peter, that for the moment at least, a closer European confederation does not seem to be on the cards. This is no time to be complacent about Europe or the relations between its peoples. Germany's role in 20th century European political history is very well known. So, how and where does modern Germany sit as a European state and within the wider post-World War II European project and framework in general?
Well, that was included in the book because, of course, it's come out in the wake of Brexit or in the latter stages of Britain going for Brexit. And as we've now seen, nobody who voted to leave really understood what they were doing, other than it was an outbreak of belated patriotism and rather angry that Germany, despite everything that happened, had remained an economic power. But of course, Germany was never after dominating Europe or never anything like it. The Germans really wanted to make their way back into a European Union, if you like, because after all, Germany was an empire, if you like, of some 16, 17 states until the Union. And even now, it's totally divided between, the powers are totally divided between the states and the central government. And so it was a pretty obvious tendency to say, well, look, we can make this work. We've made this work in Germany. And why can we not make this work on a wider plane? And of course, it was all based on names too, because on individuals, Helmut Kohl, who played a big role in German unification, got on very well with François Mitterrand, who at the time was the French president. And indeed, Angela Merkel and has done the same today, keeping it going. And it was the German-French alliance, which was very important, and then tucked in with the Netherlands and Belgium and Luxembourg. And, they were the small countries, but who had suffered a lot from the war. And she was astonishingly pleased to see that the new French president, Emmanuel Macron, is an equally fervently keen European. And to the extent that when he was elected president, he managed to put the European Union flag over his investiture and had the Ode to Joy by Beethoven rather than the French national anthem, which is a little bit more bloodthirsty. And it was just a remarkable thing. And at the same time, then when the Union expanded just a little bit further, everyone thought, what a remarkable thing is that Britain and Ireland are now together. And if only Britain had ever thought about Ireland, they would not have been the problems of Brexit. I mean, and the hilarity of during the negotiations when David Davis, already one of the main Leave candidates, he was very confused, when he was told, well, what are you going to do about your borders with the rest of the EU, your land borders? He said, we don't have a land border with you. and sort of really not considering what Northern Ireland and the Republic. So it was a great attempt to just ignore the rest of Europe, but everybody else began to see that, no, this was a good thing. And there have been ups and downs, but I've been there when Slovenia joined the European Union, when Croatia joined, and the only countries that really, Poland and Hungary, have it currently got rather right-wing governments, but even still, they have not been tempted to leave. And yet there's nor is there an absolute determination for the Germans to try and overrun Europe, to be in charge. That's the last thing they want. They want everybody to agree very gradually on bringing. There's no attempt to make a United States of Europe. What they want is a federal structure so much as a common agreement that this is the way this will stop war. The primary thing about the EU was always to stop war. There was an awful lot of talk in Britain at the time that it was nothing to do with the EU, it was all to do with NATO. Well, no, NATO was founded after the Second World War, but in the past few years, it nearly could have fallen apart. And a NATO led by Donald Trump would not have been the best thing that anyone wanted to see.
Is there anything else, Peter, that you'd like us, the listeners to Versus History, to know about your brand new book?
Well, one of the most important things, again, because so few people know a lot about the history and evolution of modern German states' relationship in Europe, is that, of course, it actually came in the first place from the attempt by both French-speaking and German-speaking on either side of the Rhine to recreate the Roman Empire, which had been a great era of peace. Now, again, this was not the Romans trying to take over Europe. This was the Romans trying to take over everything they could as a trading area. And once the empire had collapsed, so did most sensible society in all the areas north of the Alps. I have to say that at the time, again, there was no country called France. There was no country called Germany. But there was a man in around 800 who was a Frankish speaker, which means he spoke actually a form of basic German, but not quite. And he pushed back the Arabs who were coming across the Pyrenees and created a sort of a Frankish empire on its own. And he was really rather good at it, but it only they kept dividing the empire up between the sons. And so the empire gradually declined. But he had three sons. He gave divided them into three. And one was called the East of the Rhine. And the other one took his name, took the name of his empire, and called it Francia, although there is also a Franken in Bavaria at the moment. But the most important bit, it seemed at the time, was the area in between them, running down the Rhine and into as far as Rome. And he gave that to his the third son, who was called Lothar. And that's why, in the end, over about 100 years, that when the Charlemagne Empire declined, but the man in the middle, Lothar, who had inherited the rights to be emperor, was left struggling between one of his brothers on the western side, one of his others on the eastern side. And whereas they all actually spoke Latin in most of their doings, one of them had a mainly French-speaking population, the other mostly German. And this was gradually these two divide split, particularly on the Frankish side, and the Germans under the kingdom of Otto, a few hundred years later, tried to unite this in what they called the Holy Roman Empire, because the Germans had kept the German speakers had kept a hold on Rome and had been appointed by the Pope. And this continued for the best part of 800 years until Napoleon demolished it, but only because he himself also wanted to have a Holy Roman Empire of a new form and with a speaking French rather than German. So you can go right back to the beginning of modern history, to zero, to the year zero, to the birth of Christ, when things began to began to come together, and eventually Rome began to fall apart. But nobody ever really worked out that Rome didn't exist anymore. And that's it's no mistake either, no accident, that when the European Union or the its origins were settled in Rome, and it was called the Treaty of Rome. And you know, it was very, very connected all the way through, from Charlemagne to Otto, through the Habsburg family for 600 years, and then eventually demolished by Napoleon when he invaded Vienna in 1806. And it then started to call, basically, the Napoleonic Empire. He called his son, gave him the title of the King of Rome. And the idea was that he then too would succeed his father as a form of Roman emperor. It's you see, you can't really take away modern Europe without taking in everyone from the Rome of the first, second century to the those who took it over in the German in the fifth century, and eventually evolved into this Holy Roman Empire of the ninth century. And again, was taken over by the new would-be emperor of Europe, which is Napoleon.
Thanks, Peter. That was absolutely fantastic. On behalf of myself, the editorial team, and the listeners of Versus History, we're so grateful for you giving up your time to come and talk to us all about your brand new book, The Germans and Europe. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.